rescue me before I sink, lose the ship at sea. I said, from disaster. Joined by my co-hosts David West and Chuck Horton. My name is Drew Lamb. Tonight we are going to discuss medical tyranny, but first let's get into some radiation weather and nuke news. The current Geiger count in the state of Jefferson is 40 CPMs. A few minutes ago I noticed it was 62 CPMs, and I was observing radiationnetwork.com to see what Geiger counts were across the nation. And I'm currently seeing high counts here. Let's see, let's look at the East Coast, and I'll get back to that in a little bit and talk about that some more. We're seeing 63 CPMs in the New Jersey, Philadelphia area, New Jersey and Pennsylvania area. I can't tell if this counter is in Philadelphia or if it's further south, but it's very possible that this is a counter that is downwind of the Oyster Creek reactor, and I'll talk about that more in a little bit. Let's see, other high counts that I'm seeing right now, 53 CPMs down by San Francisco, and 57 up in Minnesota. I did see 80 CPMs on that counter on the East Coast near Philadelphia. And let's see, West Coast counts really aren't that bad right now. There's a couple other counters in Oregon that are showing 14, 16 CPMs. So let's get on with a little bit of Fukushima news. There hasn't been a lot going on as far as how that disaster is unfolding, and thank goodness. There was some news this week about the Japanese Olympic Committee wanting to host the 2020 Olympics. And, well, I doubt that they'll have this mess cleaned up by 2020 or even within the next 100 years or so. There were statements made from the president of the Japanese Olympic Committee. His name's Takeda, and he looks to me like he's misleading people. He's made some statements here that no one died, no one got injured from this event. He says no one's worried about the tsunami or the radiation. It's not the same far away from the Fukushima area. And it doesn't take that much research to reveal that there have been a lot of families that have moved out of Tokyo, and the number of people moving out of Tokyo exceeds the number of people moving into Tokyo. And prior to the 2011 disaster, it was the other way around. So I think people are concerned about this. And Tokyo has been exposed to the radiation, and there had been talks within the Japanese government to evacuate Tokyo. And what do you do with 30 million people? So I think that it's probably a pretty bad idea to host the Olympics in Tokyo, and I wouldn't even take a trip to Japan, actually. It's bad enough being downwind. Earlier this week, of course, everybody knows we had the Hurricane Sandy or Superstorm Sandy. There were about 26 nuclear power plants on the East Coast that were within the line of fire. There were several that experienced some problems, primarily Oyster Creek. And I'm going to pull up a report here from the NRC. This is a release from the NRC. It says, NRC maintains heightened watch over nuclear plants impacted by Sandy. Three reactors experienced shutdowns during storm. Oyster Creek plant remains in alert. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission continues to maintain its heightened watch over nuclear power plants in the northeastern U.S. impacted by Sandy. Three reactors experienced shutdowns during the storm, while another plant, Oyster Creek in New Jersey, remains in alert due to high water levels in its water intake structure. The three reactors to experience trips or shutdowns during the storm are Nine Mile Point 1 in Scriabin, New York, Indian Point 3 in Buchanan, New York, and Salem Unit 1 in Hancock's Bridge, New Jersey. Nine Mile Point 1 underwent an automatic shutdown at about 9 p.m. Monday when an electrical fault occurred on power lines used to send power to the grid. It is likely a storm-related event, but the plant's operators are still evaluating the cause. All plant safety systems responded as designed, and the shutdown was safely carried out. Meanwhile, Nine Mile Point 2 experienced a loss of one of two incoming off-site power lines as a result of the fault. One of the plant's emergency diesel generators started in response to generate power usually provided by the line. Nine Mile Point 2 remained at full power. Indian Point 3 automatically shut down at 10:40 p.m. Monday in response to electrical grid disturbances caused by the storm. All safety systems responded as designed, and the unit was placed in a safe shutdown condition. Salem Unit 1 was manually shut down by plant operators at 1:10 a.m. Tuesday as a result of circulating water pumps being affected by high river level and debris in the waterway. The circulating water system is used to cool down steam generated by the reactor. It is a closed system that does not come into contact with any radioactivity. At Oyster Creek, the alert was declared at approximately 8:45 p.m. An alert is the second lowest level of emergency classification used by the NRC. The alert was preceded by an unusual event at about 7 p.m. when the water level reached a minimum high water level criteria. The water level rose due to a combination of a rising tide, wind direction, and storm surge. While the water level has dropped since peaking earlier today, the alert will not be exited until the level is below the specific criteria for the intake structure, which is where water from an intake canal is pumped into the plant for cooling purposes. Oyster Creek was shut down for a refueling and maintenance outage prior to the storm, and the reactor remains out of service. The NRC will continue to coordinate with other federal and state agencies prior to the restart of the affected plants. The NRC stationed inspectors at all of the plants expected to experience the greatest effects of the storm. Those inspectors were tasked with independently verifying that operators were following relevant procedures to ensure plant safety before, during, and after the storm. In addition, the NRC has been monitoring the storm from its emergency response centers. Nuclear power plant procedures require that the facility shut down under certain severe weather conditions. The plant's emergency diesel generators are available if off-site power is lost during the storm. Also, all plants have flood protection above the predicted storm surge, and key components and systems are housed in watertight buildings capable of withstanding hurricane-force winds and flooding. However, I'd like to note that the intake pumps at the Oyster Creek plant in New Jersey were perhaps underwater. There's been varying reports that the water from a storm surge was either 6 inches below or 4 inches above the intake pumps, and these pumps are not submersible. They won't operate while they're underwater. Perhaps they should think about getting some submersible pumps so that they would continue to operate if they were underwater, because I think that would be a pretty good idea to be able to do that. You know, this is similar to the situation that happened at Fukushima, where their diesel generators couldn't operate because they were located in the basement of the structures, which was flooded. Another thing, just because these units or this plant in particular was in a shutdown mode, but I think they were refueling it. That just means that the control rods were removed from the reactor, but you still have these issues with the spent fuel pool and having to keep the spent fuel pool cooled off. And they did experience a power loss at the Oyster Creek plant. And so they were trying to figure out how, if they started having problems cooling it, how they were going to keep the spent fuel pool cool. And their plan was to use the fire suppression system, basically hose down the spent fuel pool with fire hoses. And I don't know how long they could do something like that for. Just given the high counts over there, I suspect that radiation levels have increased, and I think that counter on the East Coast and the New Jersey, Pennsylvania area is probably picking up radiation from Oyster Creek. And Arne Gundersen had noted that a plant shut down for refueling is an even more dangerous situation due to the evaporation of water in the hot spent fuel pool. The system it doesn't just cool off. They have to constantly add water to it. You have to have some sort of pumping system, which requires electricity. They can't just shut a plant down. Oyster Creek was built in 1969 and is the oldest operating plant in the United States. It was originally licensed to operate for 40 years, and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission extended the license by 20 years in 2009. And there's another situation going on over there. There are natural gas fires about 10 miles from this plant. So we should keep an eye on this. This very well can end up being America's Fukushima. And well, given the way the wind blows, they could end up affecting Europe. And, well, ultimately what comes around goes around. So, Chuck, I'm going to turn the floor over to you, and we get into medical tyranny.
Good. Well, hey, and you know, this all this stuff that's happening with the reactors and the radiation. This is a kind of a maybe a squirrely tie-in, but this is really important to your health also. And after you hear some of the stuff we have to say about doctors, you may want to be looking to some other ways to find ways to take care of your body other than relying on your medical industry, because I really don't think they have all the answers for healthcare. And we're going to medical tyranny. I became very aware that this summer, actually, I kind of didn't like the medical system we had. I knew it wasn't a free market. And but I went along with it. It's just, I had other things that I thought were more important. I didn't want to really get into this. There's so many things that go on that I thought needed attention. And then it kind of affected me personally. I was diagnosed about 10 years ago with high blood pressure, hypertension. And I'd been on a medication to treat that. And it came time to do a refill, and my refill was denied by the doctor because he wanted to force a visit to check up on me. And I, as a part of that, I had to also schedule to have a full blood test thing done. He wanted to test all the stuff in my blood. Total bill for that was going to run me about $600. And I says, you know, I was really kind of disgusted by the whole thing. But then I found out it was going to be 3 weeks before I could get in to see the doctor and get my prescription filled. And I said, you know, this is going to be a good chance for me to test out my theories that I could fix my blood pressure with just diet, exercise, nutrition. So I started to take that task on, and ultimately I succeeded, and I'll tell you about that later. But what I did find out in the meantime, in reading lots of things about medical industry and all this sort of stuff, is there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of information out there that people should know that's just denied them through one way or the other. And we don't really have a free market in the medicine industry, and we haven't had one for over 100 years. And this is largely due to the efforts of the American Medical Association, the AMA. And they have kind of adopted something similar to what you'd call a guild system in medicine. excuse me. Some of you might remember in the medieval Europe, there were guilds, trade guilds, for if you wanted to have something, there were coopers who made barrels. There were masons who did all the masonry work. There were carpenters who did all the carpentry work. You had a trade for everything that needed to be done, and only the trades could do it. And if people tried to step out and do something on their own, the trades would take care of it. So it was kind of a very primitive economic system. Didn't work very well. It caused things to cost more money than they should, and generally just slowed the economy down. Well, that's kind of how our medical system works today. We have the AMA, and they're in charge of the doctors. And they make sure that nobody becomes a doctor unless they're come up to their standards, which are quite high, but are not necessarily have anything to do with medicine or healing. So let's get into some history of this and how we've come to this point in time. American Medical Association, excuse me, I started to talk too fast. The American Medical Association was founded in 1847. Now at that time, medicine looked a lot different than it does today. And the original purpose of the AMA was to further the interests of allopathic doctors. So those are the MDs. Those are what we would mostly consider a doctor today. When you hear the word doctor, that's what most people are referring to. But the allopathic doctors of that day suffered a lot from competition in the marketplace. They were primarily this competition came from homeopaths. But also there were some naturopaths, chiropractors, herbalists, possibly even some osteopaths. There were different kinds of medical treatment being taught in a lot of different kinds of medical schools. People had a lot of choices. And the main reason the MDs had a lot of competition is they didn't have a very good reputation because most of their patients died on a regular basis, actually. They believed in things like bloodletting, using leeches. They inject people with mercury. A lot of their patients developed infections because they weren't sanitizing themselves. And there was a lot of other conventional allopathic medicine of the day that really wasn't very wise or shouldn't have been conventional at all. And so that a lot of people wanted to stay away from those kinds of doctors. They were okay if you had a broken leg. They could set a bone or do something like that. But broken the skin or something, you ran the risk of having it be infected because they just weren't really very good at what they did. And so the AMA had a reasonable goal, and they started out to try and improve the reputation, performance of the doctors that were allopaths. And they set out to do that. And by the turn of the 20th century, they had improved their image somewhat. They had done this by increasing the educational requirements for those entering into allopathic medicine teaching schools. So they were getting a better class of applicant or future doctor. And this better class of doctor wasn't really any better at performing the tasks that they were given, but they were of a higher social class, so they were more acceptable to people, I guess. I don't understand it, but that still happens today. They still face vigorous competition from the other branches of medical care because the other branches were more effective. How about that? And so the people within the AMA decided that they had to double down on their emphasis on education and actually establish... they wanted to establish allopathic medicine as the dominant form of care as it is today, and so they started an organization called the Council on Medical Education, or CME, in 1904, and they this organization within the AMA was set up to figure out how to educate the allopathic doctors into the medicine that they knew today at an even greater level than they had before, and to also spread bad comments about the other forms of medicine, or trying to promote all the failures of the other medicine while promoting the successes of the allopathic medicine and trying to hide their failures. And to do this, they they were trying to use media and all sorts of different things, and posters and whatever people use the day to advertise stuff. They were part of that, but they were increasing their educational model, and they wanted to make the other branches of medicine face the same requirements that they had imposed on their own allopathic brand of medicine. And to do this, they went to all the state legislatures, they'd set up a system in all the states whereby there was accreditation of the medical schools, and they had then they would license the doctors that graduated from the accredited schools, which seemed very innocuous at the beginning. I mean, it gave the state some additional revenues. They were happy to deal with this, and who else to watch over something than a third party that didn't have a financial interest in it, but they really do. So once they had that system set up, they went to one of the philanthropic foundations that had been set up by the Western wealthy industrialists of the 19th century. And it's like in oil, there was Rockefeller, and steel, there was Carnegie. And they went to the Carnegie Institute, or the foundation, and they got them to sponsor a study of all the medical colleges in America. They went to every single, literally every single school that taught medicine in the United States. And to do this, they selected a guy to go out and just go and monitor each school and compile a report, and then they were going to publish it. When I got to this point, I said I had to have a wait a minute moment. Wait a minute moment is something. I'm reading the story of this. I said, this just all seems to me like it can't be the way they're telling the story. And I'm doing my research online. So, these wealthy industrialists had been propelled to success by the superior nature of the products they produced and the increased efficiencies that made what they produced less expensive to the consumer. And the AMA was proposing to gain the same sort of market dominance, but they didn't have a better product. And as for lower costs, well, the doctors had to be paid handsomely, or they wouldn't be able to attract the best and brightest needed for good health care. So the lower costs were never a concern to the AMA in their quest for market dominance. So they weren't doing anything that the industrialists could champion, because it was not what the industrialists had done to gain their dominance. So it's hard for me to believe these guys just went for this without questioning it, or that they were fooled. Or these are sharp guys. They didn't make these fortunes by just falling off logs. They were really smart people, and they believed in the system that had given this dominance. They didn't believe in rigging the markets, or maybe they did. That's what I kind of maybe suspect. maybe they had seen that that's a easier way to get to the desired goal, and just using science to make a better production method and improve the quality of your products was too hard of a way to get to market dominance. It's going to be too difficult in medicine. So this goal of doing this survey to improve medicine, I don't think it holds any water. I don't think that was really their stated goal. I think that was what they told people to remove objections to what they were doing, and their stated goal was to grant themselves a monopoly in the medical profession. But anyway, that's my first wait a minute moment. That part of gaining the support of these foundations just didn't seem to hold water to me. So anyway,
to do this, the Carnegie Foundation chose a guy named Abraham Fixner, or Abner Fixner, as he was known, to perform a thorough review of all the medical schools in operation at the time. Now, we have to stop here and tell you a little bit about Mr. Fixner. He had he was quite young. He was in his 20s. And he was the former owner of a bankrupt prep school and had authored a book that was called The American College, which was kind of a pretentious book about how education at the university level could be improved. So prior to being chosen for this assignment, Mr. Flexer had never set foot in a medical school of any kind or even attended the simplest of medical procedures that were common in that day. So he virtually knew nothing about medicine. He knew nothing about teaching medicine. He knew nothing about medical practices, period. Years after his report, Mr. Flexer admitted that he knew very little about medicine or how to differentiate between different qualities of medical education. This was when he was maybe in his 50s. But he was the one they chose for this task, and for 18 months he traversed the country, going from school to school, making notes on how he perceived these schools operated. And this brings me to my next wait-a-minute moment. I find it really hard to believe that a 20-something failed educator and author of a pretentious book explaining how university education could be improved was the best man that they could find for this job. I really do. I think this guy was just a patsy. He was somebody that they set up because nobody else wanted to write this book because of the bad reputation that allopathic medicine had. And I just can't believe that he was the guy that they picked. And it became a little bit easier to believe when I discovered that his brother Simon worked at the Rockefeller Institute of Medical Research. And so maybe he had some inside connections in that circle of society. And then later I found out that on his journey, in his 18-month journey around all these schools, he was accompanied by an aide who was employed by the American Medical Association. And this man had his ear for the entire 18 months. So he was brainwashed and manipulated into believing the things that this guy told him about all these things. And all of his reports were very negative about any medical school that taught anything but allopathic medicine. And even some of the allopathic schools, he was very critical of them. And he really didn't know anything about medicine. So he didn't know the first thing. He didn't even know the first part of the first thing about medicine. I mean, he knew absolutely nothing about it. And so being criticized by this person was probably, it just rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. But to be truthful, this report changed the medical industry in the United States forever. It was a huge turning point, and it gave AMA the beachhead that they needed to extend their dominance in the medical profession so that they, gained their virtual monopoly. Okay, now, very few schools escaped the wrath that Flexner unloaded on the status quo that was out there. Among the few that he gave praise to is John Hopkins, which was an excellent school, but it was also an AMA school. And so gave it to the Harvard Medical School, which wasn't an AMA school. And it's amazing how you read the history of this, and the things that seem to be readily apparent to me, or I kind of have to read between the lines to see them. They just kind of leave it out of there, and they just gloss over the stuff that just doesn't make any sense. But this guy's report, it changed how things happened. So you have to... we have to admit that, and we have to say, just exactly how did this happen? But once it did happen, all the state's accreditation board suddenly adopted his report as we have to start requiring more of these teaching schools in order for them to get accreditation and in order for their graduates to be licensed to practice in our state. Well, that all the state licensing boards, they knew a little bit more about medicine than Flexner, but they were taking advice from somebody who knew nothing about medicine, which just doesn't make any sense how this could go away. I think there was a lot of money changing hands at the same time. And anyway, one of the unintended consequences of all this was a lot of these medical schools that were operating they were taught by doctors who were doing this part-time. It's kind of like almost like an apprenticeship. And they were extending their knowledge and expertise for whatever it was, at whatever level it was, to people who maybe couldn't afford to go to an extensive medical university at that time that included almost all minorities and women were included in this thing. And so those people were kind of shut out of the medical profession for generations. And that was all a result of this report. And I started to call this an unintended consequence, and I got to thinking and say, you know, this was the same period of time when there was a lot of eugenics was very popular among people, and it was kind of the birth of the of fascism, and which was kind of the model that they were using for their economic system and of medicine. And so I don't know if all this was exactly unintended or they just kind of tried to sweep it under the rug. They said, well, this is good. They knew it was going to happen, but they didn't want to highlight it. But they really, the only people who benefited from this were the, maybe the upper 2 or 3% of the white males. And that was it. So, you know, and this, this is at the same time when, you know, birth control began to be used. And birth control, by the way, was started by a horrible person, Margaret Sanger. She was a virulent racist. And to her, the people who were the lower classes, and mostly she meant blacks by lower classes, she considered them to be weeds in the human crop. And they were a subspecies to her. And so all this stuff that treats her as a hero and all sorts of stuff, that's just a bunch of crap. She was a horrible person. But with that kind of, you knew, if you don't realize that that kind of attitude and intellectual comment was prevalent during that time, and you can kind of start to see how this was taking place and how that was allowed to go forward. So anyway, I questioned to myself, what was the real goal of the AMA then? It certainly wasn't the stated goal of improving medicine. I mean, that's what they said it was. But improving medicine was just the curtain that they used to pull in front of what their real goal was, so that people, you know, would be satisfied or put off by that. It gave them credibility where they didn't have any. The real goal was to improve the status and financial position of the people who belong to the AMA, the allopathic doctors. Okay, so the next question I had for myself was, why did they go to the wealthy industrialists to finance the conversion to their new system? Well, that's kind of why people who rob banks, is that's where the money is. And I want you to know that these industrialists spent millions of dollars on the behalf of this project. And this was at a time in the United States when 10 hours of work paid $1. And so millions of dollars, it would be like tens of billions today. It's just an enormous sum of money was spent to complete this. And I have trouble believing that it was only philanthropy. Possibly it is, but I think that the industrials saw a way to invest in this and also invest in the medicines that these allopathic doctors would then be taught to prescribe for different ailments. That if they could produce the stuff that these guys were telling everybody they needed to take, there would be a profit for them. Now, I don't think that any of these industrials ended up in the pharmaceutical industry, but it doesn't matter. To me, that would be a justification for them to spend that much money. Anyway, you know, today we have I have a hard time seeing these people as saviors of humanity. You know, today we have an industrialist in the computer industry, Bill Gates, who stands up in front of a crowd of people, and I've seen this on YouTube many times, and he's talking to them about overpopulation, all the problems that goes. He says, there's great hope for the future. And he sees vaccines as showing great promise in limiting population growth. And everybody stands up and they applaud. And so if vaccines are showing great promise in limiting population growth, that must mean that they're going to kill people with vaccines or make them sterile. And so that's kind of the twisted way some of these people get. I don't know if it's just they're only good at what they do, and you get them into a social system or social realm and they flounder. I'm not sure, but anyway, I just have trouble seeing the philanthropy as the reason these people did this. I think they saw there was something for them to gain in doing it. Whether it worked out that way or not doesn't matter. So anyway, this business model then became kind of an enforced quasi-monopoly. The medical profession was limited to those who were, I guess, super qualified. There were more applicants than there were positions for them in the schools. There were fewer doctors for every 100 people or 1,000 people or whatever, however you wanted to look at it. And so there was more, the demand stayed the same. With fewer practitioners, the prices had to go up. So the cost of medicine started to rise. Now, it didn't rise as fast as it could have originally because there were still a lot of doctors practicing medicine who had been granted their licenses prior to 1910, prior to the Flexner Report. And so through the next couple of decades, those people helped keep the price down by having alternative medical care available to people who couldn't afford the higher prices that were being charged by the allopathic doctors. But those people generally went on to die off, retire, and whatever. And by the time of about 1935, the number of teaching schools in America had dropped from 166 when the Flexner Report was compiled to 66. Over 100 schools, or actually exactly 100 schools, had closed their doors forever in 25 years. And that's a huge amount. That's a lot of people that weren't being produced as doctors. There was the schools that did remain open had fewer students because of the high qualifications that were needed to become a student. So there are fewer doctors coming out of even the schools that remained. And this was a huge problem in rural America. As you know, if you're out in the country, you have to drive into the city to see a doctor. The doctors don't live out in the country. They live close to the hospitals. They live close to where the people are because they have to see a lot of people to pay off their student loans. They have to maintain, malpractice insurance. They have lots of costs, and they can't live out in rural areas. And before, when it was relatively easy to become a doctor, you could be a country doctor, and you could serve people, and it seemed to work fairly well. I mean, I imagine that a lot of people still died, but it's certainly not better to just remove all medical care completely, because some of the things that the naturopaths and the homeopaths and the osteopaths, some of the things that they were doing were effective and they worked, and they were actually discarded because they didn't have the available science to back up what they were doing at the time, and the allopaths were all about science. They refused to look at empirical evidence that showed that there was something here that was working. We need to investigate it. They said, well, you investigate it, whatever. In their defense, the AMA points out that medical care has improved dramatically since the Flexner Report was issued. And they say it's because of the emphasis that they put on increased education, and it's hard to say that they're wrong, because a lot of the things that they point to are correct. Especially in terms of medical treatment that deals with, we do things like heart replacements now and transplants. We transplant all sorts of different things. They put artificial hips and knees and just all sorts of things that they do that are just undreamed of 100 years ago. But The other side of that coin is a lot of these operations that they do for these artificial hips and knees and transplants and bypass surgeries and stents and everything are unnecessary. And doing these operations leads to some complications that kill people. And so they're not all these advances they've made aren't they're being used too much to finance a doctor's vacation house in Aruba and not enough for the benefit of the patients. Every year, MDs kill over 120,000 people and they injure over 1 million others. Now, to put this in perspective, you have to think of it as if a 747 full of passengers crashed every single day of the year for 365 days, they still wouldn't kill 120,000 people. But I bet you would be reluctant to buy a ticket to fly on the 747. Yet we still line up to go see their doctors, despite the same death toll that they're enacting on us. And I guess if you look back in the history of the allopathic doctors, that was their first problem that they had with the reaction to reputation with the public, is that they killed too many of their patients. And I guess some things don't change. Anyway, the AMA also points to increased life expectancy and lower infant mortality as evidence of their positive impact on society. And those are also both true. But those can also be attributed to other causes, such as we've improved the sanitation in the operating rooms and just in the doctor's visits, so that there's fewer people dying from infections than there used to be. And the lower infant mortality is also could be due to better prenatal care and other things that relate to nutrition and factors like that. There was a drug that was discovered quite by accident called penicillin, and that has probably more responsible for the increased life expectancy than any other thing that's happened in the 20th century. And one thing is for sure, it wasn't happened through scientific discovery, it was an accident. So I really think that AMA claiming credit for all this stuff is a little bit arrogant. And the one thing that I will say that they've done, the goal that they've accomplished, is they've made medical service and medical treatment so expensive in the United States that to be without insurance is really a traumatic experience to a lot of people. They know how much treatment costs, and they know they can't afford it, because it costs you everything you'll make in your life if you have a serious car accident, if you have if you come up with some kind of a chronic disease that needs treatment for the rest of your life, it's going to cost you everything you have and everything you'll ever have. So even though they've gone away from using leeches to suck blood from people, and they suck money out of your bank accounts, because they use you like an ATM card to produce income for themselves, and they don't ever cure you. And that's the one secret that they are not going to ever tell you. They tell you have a chronic condition that can't be cured, and you have to have this medicine because it'll alleviate the symptoms and allow you to live a more productive life and fulfilling life. And that is just crap. That isn't true. Your body replenishes itself every single day. All the cells in your liver regrow themselves once a month. So your liver is regrown once a month. If it doesn't get the proper nutrition, then it won't do that. And so if you start to attack it with alcohol or harmful drugs or whatever, it's going to lose that ability to regenerate itself. And eventually you'll die from cirrhosis. Your heart tissues, they are constantly being regenerated. And if you're taking a heart poison, like most beta blockers are heart poisons, eventually your heart will lose the ability to regenerate the cells that it needs to stay healthy, and you'll develop chronic heart disease. And these treatments that they give you that alleviate the symptoms don't treat the causes. And the causes are poor nutrition. And generally, poor nutrition comes from two sources. Either you have a bad diet, you don't eat the right foods, or if you are eating the right foods, you aren't absorbing them correctly. And this can, and just recently, you've probably been to the grocery store, you notice they now have aisles and aisles of food in the grocery stores that big labels on this say gluten-free. Well, anywhere from one-third to one-half of the people living in America are gluten intolerant, and if they're severely intolerant, they develop a disease called celiac disease, which basically seals off their digestive tract from absorbing any nutrients, and they wither away and die. They become very, very thin, and they just can't absorb nutrition, and there's nothing left. I mean, they're going to have a really shortened life. There's a lot of people on the way to that state that are eating gluten, and they're having troubles with their digestion. They're not absorbing all the nutrients they want, so they may be manifesting itself in a lot of different ways. They might have, if they're young, they might have acne. When you get older, you might have psoriasis, skin problems. You could have, in my case, it would manifest itself as high blood pressure. My doctor gave me heart poison to cure my high blood pressure. And I took that for 10 years. And let me tell you, I used to like my doctor. I thought he had my interests at heart, but he never told me about gluten. In fact, David was with me on this trip. This trip probably saved I don't know how many years on my life expectancy. It added many years to my life expectancy. But we went up to the District 2 convention to select delegates to the RNC convention in Tampa.
You might be a little optimistic there, Chuck. I'm pretty sure that the festivities later that day or the next day or whenever probably negated all those years. But you know.
Oh, maybe so, maybe not. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, on the way up, I got to speak for 3 hours or talk for 3 hours with Dr. Gala from Eagle Point. He's a chiropractor in Eagle Point, and he's a nutritional guru. And
we should get him on sometime.
We should have him on. He convinced me that all my symptoms that I had, and I had a lot of symptoms, were all from gluten intolerance, and that I needed to stop eating bread that second. I needed to stop. I couldn't have any grains or any grain products, no pasta, no breads. No beer, no vodka, unless it's potato vodka. And so I stopped, and I wasn't sure how I was going to do that because I love bread, but I did it. And eventually my blood pressure, I went off my medication. My blood pressure's below normal most days now. All my other symptoms disappeared. It's just diet and nutrition. Nutrition and absorption is what I meant to say. And so, did my doctor ever tell me that stuff? No, he didn't. And I no longer like my doctor. I don't hate him or anything. He's just another guy making a living, but he didn't have my best interest in heart. He didn't take the time to find out this stuff. Dr. Gala did. And he gave me, I was lucky to get a free 3-hour consultation with him on a trip up to Bend, Oregon. I really think if I'd continued along the path I was going, it probably wouldn't have lived much longer than the 77-year life expectancy of someone my age. And so I had, 15, 20 years left, and that would be it for me. I'd be in Box City. I think now, with all the information I've read, that it's possible to live, for human beings to live as long as 120 to 150 years. There are people that do it routinely. And one of the things that they've discovered among these peoples that have really long-lived people is they live in societies without doctors. Whoa, that was a shock for me. What do they do when they get sick? Oh, they don't get sick because they eat good food. They happen to be blessed to live in an area where they have soils that are full of minerals. They have long growing seasons. They can grow healthy food, and they eat it. They don't go to doctors and have poisons put in their body to treat symptoms that they should cure with diet. So that's the first part of medical tyranny. We have, there is a lot more. I tell you that I could probably talk for 2 more hours on this, and I'm not going to do it tonight. But there is so much in our medical system, and it's not just the doctors. Now it's pharmacies, the pharmaceutical industry, and the insurance industry, and the doctors. They form a triangle of evil. And once you're trapped in that system, it's almost impossible to get out. But if, and as long as you're in there, you're going to be a slave to their dictates. And now government is joining, making it a rectangle. So it's, the government's going to mandate that you buy insurance, and the insurance is going to mandate that you can only see certain kinds of doctors. And the pharmaceutical companies are going to they're going to continue to bribe the doctors and to pay them off with all sorts of perks to get them to prescribe the medications that destroy people's lives. And they're going to suck all the money out of the people that, you know, at, near the end of their life through all sorts of medical procedures and therapies that just enrich those four pillars of that tyranny, that box that they've got you set up in. And that's the medical system. So we have, we could do another full show on insurance. We could do another full show on pharmaceutical industry, and we can do probably another full show on the government aspect of all this and how it makes it possible. And it couldn't work without the government's involvement and the government mandating this monopoly. So
I'd love to get into insurance on a future episode.
Yeah, so anyway, I think that's a good spot to stop tonight. But any of you out there that are feeling frustrated by the medical industry, you aren't alone. Don't be one of the 120,000 people that end up pushing up daisies. And go out there and take, you know, part of freedom is taking responsibility for your own life and your own health and what you eat and, you know, making sure you get enough rest and exercise and all that. That's your responsibility, and it isn't anybody else's responsibility. And by relying on someone else to take care of you, you're allowing yourself to become a slave to that system. And you can't let it happen if you want to live a long, happy, you know, fruitful life. So that's it.
You guys have been listening to Double Cross Radio on UCY.TV, and you can listen to us every Thursday at 7 p.m. I am Drew Lamb, and you've been listening to me and Chuck Horton and David West, and that was a wonderful presentation that Chuck gave tonight, and I look forward to hearing more of this next week as we continue to expand upon this topic, and I hope you'll join us then. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.